This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A polar bear has set a new world diving record, though it's not an Olympic event yet. Researchers reporting in Polar Biology witnessed a polar bear diving for not one, not two, but 3 minutes and 10 seconds. This is not, though, a cause for celebration, but concern. Why would a polar bear spend so much time underwater when the typical length of a dive is no more than 30 seconds? Here to tell us about this and other selected short subjects in science is Rachel Feltman. She's a writer with the Washington Post's Speaking of Science blog. Welcome back, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
So what is this about the polar bear dive? Why did it dive so long?
Well, the polar bear was hunting seals, and it was diving because there were no ice floes between it and the ice floe that the seals were sitting on. Now, this is really unfortunate. There were no ice floes because waters are warming and ice is melting, and there's less food around and less ice for the polar bears to hide under while they hunt it. The polar bear had to stay under the water for 3 minutes and 10 seconds to get up to the prey without being detected, and it didn't even catch the seals, which is very sad.
So, yeah, well, no, a polar bear is white. It's up on the ice. A seal probably never sees it, but a white bear in the dark water is pretty visible.
Right. If it surfaces for air, the seals are going to see it and escape. The bear was emaciated, according to the researchers, and this is kind of one of many signs that researchers are seeing that polar bears are adapting incredibly well to climate change, but it's just not going to happen fast enough. They're heading farther north. They're being more opportunistic about prey. Recently, a researcher saw a polar bear eat a dolphin for the first time. Not their usual choice of meal, but he was hungry. And now we see them diving for much longer than is comfortable for them. So again, all very impressive, but they're not going to be able to keep adapting at this pace.
It means they're going to die out.
Well, in other words, we hope not, but things don't look great.
Okay, now you're also going to tell us maybe we don't have to fear the bubonic plague during our morning subway commute. Explain that a little bit more.
Right. So people do still occasionally get the plague. It happens. But this is from a study that came out a few months ago that a lot of people reported as saying had found the bacteria that causes bubonic plague and also the bacteria associated with anthrax on subway platforms in New York City. Now, this isn't a retraction. It's a correction to the paper because all of the data was good, but the researchers are now saying that some of the speculation they made in the paper was overblown by the media, and they want to, you know, put a stop to that. Basically, what happened is that they were looking at these fragments of microbial DNA that they found on subway stops all over New York and then running them through this system to match those fragments to a database of known microbes. Now, some of those, the system came back saying these could be bubonic plague.
Yeah.
And that did happen. It wasn't, you know, a mistake, but it's a rough science, you know, taking these fragments and trying to say what they might be. For one example, they found tons of matches for cucumbers and tons of matches for this invasive fly that we know isn't in New York City. So when you take all of that, it's pretty clear that there probably wasn't actually bubonic plague.
All right. Less something less to worry about on the number three train. A scientist in Brazil learned something new about frogs with a very painful lesson about it.
Yeah, so this researcher in Brazil was studying poisonous frogs, and then he poked his arm on this spine on the frog's head and had radiating intense pain for 5 hours. And he said, well, maybe I should look into that. And it turns out that frog wasn't poisonous, but venomous. The difference being that poison is absorbed through the skin or eaten, and venom is injected. So this is the first time we've ever seen evidence of a venomous frog, a frog that injects venom into you. And there are two species, actually, and they both have these head spines that they can use to inject venom into a predator. that is, you know, trying to grab them, presumably. Right. And one of them is actually more venomous than a pit viper. I think a gram of the venom could kill 80 humans.
Wow.
Yeah. Though they're not making nearly that much venom. You know, right. That's not what you're getting pricked with. But yeah. The researchers also said they didn't experiment with getting pricked with that one to be safe.
But they never thought frogs had spines on them. Right.
Right. Right. They thought they just secreted poison that you might absorb off of their skin. And now the researchers are saying that it's quite likely that lots of frogs that are presumed to be poisonous are in fact venomous.
Wow, that is fascinating. And you brought us a quirky story of the week?
I did. So I love this story. It's about a fungus in space.
A fungus in space?
Yeah.
And let me get the spooky music rolling.
Space mycology is my dream subject. I didn't even know it really existed. But the European Space Agency has put kombucha, which you may know as a drink that's sold in health stores, into space. And they did that not because they wanted to make the astronauts drink it, but because kombucha is this fermented tea. And it uses this thing called a SCOBY, a symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast. So it's this fungus and this bacteria that grow together into this really thick, mushy biofilm. And it's a very interesting material. You can dry it, and it turns into this really resilient, almost leather. So it's very interesting as a building material, including for off-world building. And scientists are also interested in studying how biofilms fare in space, because it's easier to look for, you know, something that grows mm-hmm. like this big, mushy colony than it is to look for a single microbe.
So they sent some into space?
So they did, yeah. The European Space Agency has this experiment on the International Space Station that's designed to just expose things to space and see what happens. So this symbiotic organism that's used to make kombucha right now is chilling in space, and we'll see how it does.
It's supposed to collect some dust or something like that, space dust?
Well, actually, interestingly enough, they did find that some biofilms seem to get stronger when they're exposed to moon dust because they can integrate the minerals. Anyway, what it's doing on the International Space Station, we'll just see how it reacts to lack of oxygen, radiation.
I can see the movie now, you know, the stuff that crawled out of the lab. It didn't know it was going to do something. Yeah. All right. Thanks for that story, Rachel.
You're welcome.
Rachel Feldman is a writer with the Washington Post, Speaking of Science blog. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And this week, the FDA approved the first 3D printed pill. The drug Spritam is produced by Aprecia Pharmaceuticals, and it's used to treat epilepsy. So what does this mean for how we'll get our medicine in the future? Someday, are we going to be able to print out prescription drugs on our own? Here to take us to the pros and cons of 3D printed medications is Jim Rubel. He's Associate Professor of University of Utah's College of Pharmacy, Chair of the Ethics Committee for the University's Healthcare System. He joins us from KUER in Salt Lake. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. It's a privilege to be with you.
You're welcome. So this is a good thing. What is good about this pill?
Well, this pill is an advance in engineering. It's an advance in healthcare. The active drug in it, levetiracetam, is not new. We've had it for a long time. But the way in which it's produced with this 3D printer enables more of the drug to be placed into the tablet, and it actually improves how it's absorbed so that it can be administered a little more quickly to the patient. Now, what this technology does is it's really paradigm shifting. It represents, in a way, the digital transformation of pharmacy and healthcare. It facilitates an emerging field that's called personalized medicine, where therapies are custom-tailored or custom-targeted for patients to improve their outcomes. The University of Utah, a lot of other institutions are actively engaged in this field. So as one example of this, we might have a patient, say, for example, who's on maybe 8 to 10 medicines, maybe more. And by using this 3D printing technology, it may be possible, not at this point, but perhaps soon, to take those 8 to 10 medicines and consolidate them down to maybe 2 or 3 tablets. Hmm. You know, and in that case, the patient's taking far fewer number of dosage forms per day. We would expect that their adherence with their therapies would improve. Ultimately, it would improve their outcomes and their health. And that's a good thing.
And the bad thing.
Well, this may also be an example of where technology outpaces really society's ability to establish values and rules for proper use. When the music industry transformed 30 years ago from an analog format to a digital format, it was widely embraced. The quality of music improved, the access to music improved, but there were a lot of economic challenges. We had to have new laws, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. There were new avenues of piracy that society had to grapple with. So, not the least of which is who bears the burden of the cost of deploying the technology into society. So while digital medicine is different from digital music, there's some similarities. Mm-hmm. If we print a medicine from a software code, this may enable other ways to divert this good technology for bad uses.
You mean other people might print it themselves?
Well, depending upon where the technology is deployed, in theory, it could be in their home, or it could be perhaps not in a healthcare facility. I don't think that's in the near future, mm-hmm. downstream, but the notion of what a designer drug is, as well as we've heard of software glitches before or hacking, certainly those could be elements where there could be real patient harm or perhaps even a death as a result of some of those elements.
So what's your closing thought on this?
Well, this really radically transforms the notion, or may, at least downstream in the future, about what a pharmacy is. So this appears exceptionally promising. At the same time, we've got to thoughtfully consider as a society what its deployment's going to be, mm-hmm. how the economics are going to be justified, and who benefits.
We've heard this so many times over the course of the decades. Thank you, Jim, for taking time to be with us today. Jim Rubel, Associate Professor, University of Utah's College of Pharmacy, Chair of the Ethics Committee for the University's Healthcare System. When we come back, we're going to take a break. We're going to break down President Obama's new clean power plan, and we're going to take a tour of the Arctic, which is, yes, melting and turning into a melting pot for species up there. We'll talk about it. Live updates from Greenland. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. One of the most difficult things to buy is a mattress, right? Lying on a bed for 4 minutes in a showroom is not very convincing. And you can pay a lot of money for that mattress. Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses, has a better idea. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing the savings on to you. That's why Casper offers a 100-day risk-free trial and painless return policy. Their mattresses are obsessively engineered, too. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for just the right sink and just the right bounce. Casper mattresses are made in America and outstandingly priced. $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-size. And today, you can save an additional $50. Go to casper.com/scifry and insert the promo code SCIFRY. Casper mattresses for better nights and better mornings. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. President Obama announced his Clean Power Plan earlier this week, a plan to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 32% from their 2005 levels, do that over the next 15 years.
This is one of those rare issues because of its magnitude, because of its scope, that if we don't get it right, we may not be able to reverse. And we may not be able to adapt sufficiently. There is such a thing as being too late when it comes to climate change.
The plan is already under attack, and not just from fossil fuel interests like coal, but from the other side, too, from people who say the plan doesn't go far enough, nearly far enough. Which side are you on? Give us a call, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Joining me now to give us his take on the plan, and I have it on good authority that he has read the entire plan, which is all 1,500 160 pages?
Unfortunately.
David Biello, the environment and energy editor at Scientific American here in New York. Read the whole thing.
I did. There's actually a lot of interesting history buried in there, along with the hundreds of pages of legalese. But we can get into the weeds of that if you really want to.
Well, I want to get into some of it. What's your take on the plan? Does it go far enough?
So what I like to say is that it's both important and insufficient. So it's important in that it's the first real thing the United States has ever really done to clean up CO2 emissions from power plants. And that is the single largest source of our CO2 pollution. On the other hand, it doesn't go anywhere near far enough in cleaning up that CO2 pollution to meet kind of the internationally agreed goals for holding back global warming. We want to keep warming from less than 2 degrees Celsius, concentrations below 450 parts per million, all these numbers you've heard before. Mm-hmm. This plan doesn't get us all the way there.
And part of the plan is it leaves it up to individual states to decide.
That's right.
How they're going to do it.
That's right. And actually, about half of the cuts under the Clean Power Plan have actually already happened. So the states, without doing anything, are already halfway home.
So that's what some of the critics are saying. As you say, it doesn't go far enough. Half the states already can do that.
That's right. That's right. And in defense of the Clean Power Plan, some of the states are going to do things that are more aggressive than the Clean Power Plan. And what it really is designed to do is to take those states that are doing nothing or doing worse than nothing, actually building more coal-fired power plants and other highly polluting forms of electricity generation and force them to rethink things and prevent that from happening. So it's good as a backstop. That's why it's important. It's just not all the way there.
Mm-hmm. The president says that the Clean Power Plan will save the average American family nearly $85 annually on energy bills in 2030 and create tens of thousands of jobs. Sound about right? You read the whole thing?
The jobs claim is the less credible one. Saving money, that's actually true. The $85 largely comes from the fact that natural gas is so cheap that generating electricity with it, which is one of the three main pillars of the Clean Power Plan, will result in much cheaper electricity.
And so why is the jobs a sort of a reach?
Well, it's harder to tell what exactly the states will do and how exactly those jobs will be created. So if they build a bunch of wind farms, that's great. There'll be a bunch of construction jobs. If they just switch to burning more natural gas in existing power plants and shutting off coal-fired power plants, that might actually lead to job losses.
And like all long-term projects, this is very political in that the next president, whoever he or she may be, will have to continue with this or else it could just go away.
Right? Correct. Although this is going to be a little bit harder to overturn than some may think. The Supreme Court actually said that EPA has to do something about carbon dioxide. So it might not take the form of the Clean Power Plan exactly, but something has to be done. And it would be somewhat hard to overturn everything that's been set in motion with this Clean Power Plan. Nonetheless, there are going to be a lot of lawsuits. So
that's the next thing is lawsuits. Or if this goes ahead, what is the next step for the plan in the states itself? Do they have to draw up their own plans?
Correct. So if there are no lawsuits, which will not happen, all states are required to submit their plans by 2018, and those plans take effect in 2022 and reach full effect in 2030, which is when you get that 32% cut. Mm-hmm. If states do not submit a plan, then the federal government will create a plan for them. That plan comes in the form of what is known as cap and trade, right, a multi-state trading program for CO2 pollution.
Well, it worked for acid rain.
It did.
It might work for this. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Louisville. Bob Edwards taught me how to say that. Louisville, Kentucky. Seabrook, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, happy to be here. Big fan.
Thank you. Go ahead.
All right. Well, I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. And when this announcement was made by President Obama, Mitch McConnell, my senator, his first reaction was, I cannot support this. This will affect jobs in my state. Now, he's correct. Coal money and coal jobs are a major part of the economy in our state. However, at what point do we stop talking about jobs and recognize that the planet is more important? You know, we can talk about coal jobs for decades, but someday the coal jobs will be gone, but we'll be left with, you know, a planet that's not healthy.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, and I think what's also important to note is that there are a number of programs for retraining coal miners and other folks in the coal industry that, you know, that have not been adequately utilized, let's put it that way. So I think that if folks are going to lose their jobs, there might be other people to blame besides President Obama.
Just a little sidetrack on this. The first Republican presidential debate last night, not one word about the environment was asked.
Well, the JV Club, Senator Lindsey Graham talked about climate change a little bit, and they talked about Keystone XL, but not, no, it was not a focus. Let's put it that way.
Hard to believe. Okay, you know, I want to bring out another guest because, as you know, the places that are being hit hardest by global warming are, as you might expect, some of the coldest places like the Arctic, which is warming about twice as fast as the rest of the planet, and the resulting climate change in the Arctic are diverse, and some of them are just downright weird. We're going to be talking about what's happening, and I'm going to check in by satellite phone with a couple of scientists on the scene in Alaska and in Greenland. And first up is a veteran of Arctic research. Brendan P. Kelly is chief scientist at the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira.
Why is this Arctic such a hot spot for rapid warming?
Well, for a number of reasons, but probably the biggest one is simply that as you warm the Arctic, you're melting a lot of ice, right? And particularly sea ice, but also glaciers and ice sheets. And as you melt sea ice, you really change what is a really highly reflective surface that reflects most of the sun's energy back out of the atmosphere into open water, which is a rather absorbing surface. So for every little bit of ice we melt, we warm up the ocean more and melt more ice. And so you have this accelerating feedback, and that's a large reason why the Arctic is warming so much more rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about pizzly bears. What are pizzly bears, Brendan?
Okay, well, this is a fanciful term for hybrids between polar bears and grizzly bears. And it turns out that polar bears and grizzly bears are rather closely related. They haven't diverged all that long ago in evolutionary history. And so they can interbreed. But starting in 2006, I believe, people started encountering hybrids in the wild, and several have been harvested, including one that was a second-generation hybrid. In other words, one of his parents itself was a hybrid, and others have been seen on the ice. And so it's raised a real question is, so what will be the impact kind of genetically of this rapid change in Arctic environments, particularly sea ice environments.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've always said when we cover the environment or global warming, follow the money, follow the politics. And it happened again this week. Russia just staked a new claim in the Arctic this week, David, including the North Pole.
That's right.
They know that it's open now, that the water's open, it can be harvested.
Yes, and there's a lot of oil up in that, underneath that water, which, you know, it's one of the ironies of global warming that the oil that has helped to drive global warming is opening up new oil reserves to drive yet further global warming. But we're at a real disadvantage, actually, when it comes to studying the Arctic, or if it comes to it, defending our Arctic interests. The U.S. currently has one polar icebreaker. Mm-hmm. I believe Russia has about 40. 10 of which are nuclear-powered.
The HBO show Vice did a special on this a few months ago, talking about the defenses that all the Arctic nations bordering the Arctic are now having to beef up.
That's right. We're going to put lasers on growler bears.
Well, we're joking about it, but who knows what could really happen
up
there, right?
DARPA's probably studying it.
Brendan, now that it's raining up in the Arctic instead of snowing, we're seeing some weird changes associated with that, right?
Well, that's true, and it has a lot of ramifications. One that I've had particular experience with is the impact on ring seals, which are the primary prey of polar bears, incidentally, and probably were was a resource that allowed the original human occupation of the Arctic, because it was a year-round source of food and fuel. But these seals live under sea ice and maintain breathing holes through that ice with big claws, heavy claws on their front flippers. And then where those holes become snow-covered early in the winter, and the seals come up and they're breathing under the snow. And where the snow drifts and gets deep enough above a breathing hole, the seals can reach up and excavate a snow cave above the breathing hole. And so they'll come out of the water, and they're resting on top of the ice, but they're encapsulated in the snowdrift. And it's actually in those snow caves that the young are born in the springtime, and the pups spend the first couple months of their lives, ideally concealed and protected in that snow cave from extreme cold as well as from predators. But what we're seeing happen is we have these increasingly early rain events, and before the pups are ready to be independent, the rain collapses the snow cave, exposing the pup to predators and also to subsequent cold snaps. So the temperature gets cold again. Now this little pup is lying wet on the ice. And so ironically, you have freezing deaths as a result of climate warming.
Interesting. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I want to bring on a guest now who is in Greenland. Ari Danielle is a science reporter for NOVA and our friends over at PRI's The World. His trip to Greenland was supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Welcome to Science Friday, Ari.
Hi there, Ira. It's nice to be here.
Tell us where you guys are right now and what it looks like.
Yeah, so we're in southeast Greenland right now aboard a small research vessel, and we're surrounded by icebergs, and some are as big as a stadium. So we're in a fjord right now, which you can kind of think of as a canyon that's filled with seawater, and if we were to keep heading up into the fjord, we'd eventually reach Helheim Glacier, which is one of Greenland's biggest glaciers. In fact, last week I was up there camping alongside a team of glaciologists, and it's just extraordinary. It ends in a 30-foot canyon of ice that calves into the sea, and that's where all of these icebergs are coming from, and they're heading out into the North Atlantic.
How fast is that glacier moving?
It's moving about 3 feet per hour.
3 feet per hour, calving off into the water?
That's right. That's right.
I want to bring on a few. Go ahead.
No, please, go ahead.
I want to bring on Fiamma Strania, who's a physical oceanographer and senior scientist at Woods Hole in Massachusetts. Fiamma, why that particular glacier? Why are you interested? What are you interested in finding out there?
Hi, Ira. So Helheim, as Ari Daniel said, it's one of Greenland's largest glaciers, and it's part of a suite of glaciers that sort of started picking up and moving faster about a decade ago. And this is part of the bigger picture of Greenland changing. So picture Greenland as a large block of ice sitting on land, and it's been melting. And each year it melts a little bit more than the year before. And just to put it in perspective, Greenland alone has caused sea level to rise about a third of an inch over the last 20 years. So what I'm here to find out is what role is the ocean playing in these changes that we're seeing in Greenland. And so we do this by coming into a fjord, like Ari described, and we're on a ship, and we're making measurements of currents and water. And so we get an idea of what the fjord conditions are like right now. We also leave instruments anchored to the seafloor so that they can be our eyes in the fjord when we're not here. And really what we're trying to track here is the flow of warm waters from the Atlantic. These are the same waters that the Gulf Stream carries across the Atlantic. They're warm. They've soaked up heat in the tropics. and they come all the way to the margins of these large glaciers in Greenland, and they're melting the underside. So this is really what we're tracking in here.
Are you a little surprised at how quickly that glacier is moving?
Yeah, I am surprised at how quickly it's moving. And so the idea here is that they're melting the underside. If you increase the melting, these glaciers are sitting in maybe 2,000 feet of ocean water. So it's really has a large contact with the ocean. And so if you increase the melting under the glacier, you can make it thinner underneath, and this can cause it to speed up. And so this drainage, glaciers are like a river of ice. They move ice from land into the ocean, and if you speed up the rate at which this is happening, then you can cause sea level to rise, and you're putting more fresh water into the ocean, which has all sorts of other implications.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us. I know it's a little windy, and taking time out of your day today. Fiamma Stranio is a physical oceanographer, senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts. Ari Daniel is a science reporter for NOVA, and our friends over at PRI's The World. His trip to Greenland was supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
I'd like to say I wish I was there, actually. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the Arctic. David Bellow is still with us. We'll be right back after this break. Hey, podcast listeners. When I was told that we had a new podcast advertiser, Harrys.com, I said, great. I already know those folks because I use their razor and blades. No need to talk me into it. And you know what I like about Harry's? It's that there's a bunch of entrepreneurs dedicated to making shaving a better experience through great design, meticulous craftsmanship, terrific value, and highly personal and dedicated customer service. Makes sense we'd get together, doesn't it? Harry's uses high-quality German-made blades and razors that virtually eliminate razor burn and nicks. And they cost half the price of other razors. And they deliver them right to your door. Harry's literally takes the pain out of shaving. And because you are a Sci-Fry podcast listener, you're going to get a special discount. A Harry's starter set that includes a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and three razor blades for just $15. And if you order now at Harrys.com, they're going to give you $5 off if you type in my coupon code Friday with your first purchase. It's an amazing shave without the hassle from Harrys.com, and you can't beat it. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the changing Arctic with my guests, David Bielow, an environment and energy editor at Scientific American. Brendan P. Kelly is chief scientist at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And I'd like to bring on another guest way up north in Alaska. George Tavoki is the director of the Friends of Cooper Island, and he joins us by satellite phone from Cooper Island, Alaska. Welcome to Science Friday, George.
Good morning, Ira.
You've been studying birds for 41 years in Alaska, and you've noticed changes over the years?
Yes. One needs long-term data sets to really look at change, and I studied black guillemots, a seabird, on Cooper Island for 28 years, the first 28 years, seeing no major climate change. And since 2003, have seen rapid changes occur, and both in snow and ice cover. Snow used to cover the island up until mid-June. This past spring, snow melted from the island in close to mid-May. Ice used to be right next to the island and provide food for the chicks that were being fed on the island. There's a fish that is under the ice that the parents feed on. The ice is now pulls offshore hundreds of miles, and chicks starve every year now. So I've seen rapid climate change occur and happen to have 28 years of pre-change data to show how that change is occurring.
Wow. And how are the birds responding to these changes in the climate? Have you noticed other species changing their habits too?
Well, yes. One of the things that has happened is as the ice has pulled offshore and has taken the chicks' food away, the polar bears that were on the ice eating Brendan's seals have to find food elsewhere. So they come to the island. They basically lose the platform that they walk on. And they started eating my guillemot chicks in 2003 or so. And I had to start putting out plastic nest cases because I wanted to keep the study going so the polar bears didn't have access to the chicks. So that all of the
George, we I think we lost George.
Uh-oh.
Oh, are you there, George? George, one last chance. Go ahead.
Currently, they are in plastic cases.
Wow. So this is all stuff that's you've watched this, as you say, for 41 years, but it's all relatively a new change.
Well, it was really there was a gradual change in the time of egg laying from the mid-70s when I started up through the 1990s. It was a very gradual change. Eggs were being laid a day or two earlier every few 5 or 10 year periods. And then in 1990, there was a major change as things started to warm up. And since then, the summer has gotten very long. It used to be there was 80 days when the island didn't have snow on it every summer. Now it's as much as 140.
Wow.
So and that major change has taken place in the last decade and ties in with lots of other studies that show that in the last decade, since the turn of the century, climate change in the Arctic and elsewhere has taken place much more rapidly.
All right, we're going to have to say goodbye to George. George Tavoki, director of the Friends of Cooper Island, thank you for taking time to be with us today, and good luck to you and your studies up there. Brendan, if more species are shifting north to the Arctic as it warms up, what's the problem with that? I mean,
the problem comes in that it's hard for those northern species to shift north, right? And they kind of run out of a place to go. Mm. And so they're going to be, the existing species will be experiencing more and more competition with other species. And it's hard to know how that'll play out. There will likely be some species that will adapt to the change and others that won't. I think one of the things that's really important to understand, and George's remarkable data set really underscores this, is that what's really important here is the rate of change. So, you know, organisms can adapt and have adapted in the past to habitat changes, but the pace, the ability to adapt is really dependent on the pace of change. So, and particularly the pace of change relative to the generation time of the species. So for a habitat change that happens over many, many generations, it's possible for, you know, evolutionary adaptations to accommodate that. Mm. But if the change happens, you know, in just a few generations, which is sort of what's happening with sea ice and long-lived species like George's guillemots and ringed seals and polar bears and walruses, when that happens, it's very hard for adaptation, to take place on such a short time scale. So now not only is that the physical habitat changing for a lot of these species that are really tightly adapted to sea ice, but they're also now increasingly competing mm-hmm. with other species, further kind of stressing their adaptive abilities.
David, do you think any and all of these issues will come up at the Paris meeting coming up this fall?
For sure they will come up. And an interesting side note, Alaska is probably the state most affected by climate change. It is not included in the Clean Power Plan at this juncture, so has no climate targets of its own. There's a lot of weird stuff going on in Alaska.
In Russia, too? And there's
a lot of weird stuff going on in Siberia, Scandinavia. Scandinavia, Canada as well. Yet most of those countries have played a skeptical role in international climate negotiations. I've even heard Russian negotiators say, hey, a little climate change isn't a bad thing. Perhaps they think Siberia will be open to farming.
They want to claim the North Pole.
They want to claim the North Pole, so, you know.
They sent a little flag. Didn't they once plant a flag?
That's right,
with the submarine. On the ocean floor?
Yep, yep. And it all comes back to the Lomonosov Ridge, which Canada and Russia will apparently fight over for the rest of time. But, you know, there is hope, too, with the U.S. action. I guess we've signed our credibility to the rest of the world. We've signaled it, and that's going to help with international negotiations.
A small first, but significant first
exactly.
step.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. We've run out of time. I'd like to thank all of you. David Biello, Environment and Energy Editor at Scientific American. Brendan P. Kelly, Chief Scientist at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And I'll also thank George Devokey, who is Director of Friends of Cooper Island. Thanks to all of you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. All right, everybody. Settle down. That's right. It's time to bring up our Sci-Fi Book Club to order. Thank you all for joining us for this month's book selection. Now, last winter, we ventured deep into the gnat-infested Amazon jungle. You'll recall, and we really enjoyed reading, David Grand's tale of Victorian-era exploration, The Lost City of Z. Well, this time, the only bugs we're going to encounter are in the hardware. Oh, good pun. You'll see what I mean. Here to introduce our new book is SciArts producer Annie Minoff. Annie, welcome back.
Well, thank you. I did work very hard on that pun. So I'm glad you appreciated it.
Tell us what the pun is all about, then. The book ties in with the book.
I don't think we could be going any further from the Amazon jungle with this book. So we are stepping back in the Wayback Machine, heading back to the late 1970s. And if you were an up-and-coming computer engineer back then, you know, maybe you wouldn't head out to Silicon Valley. Where you'd be going is the 128 corridor in central Massachusetts. This was the hotbed, and this is where our next book is set. It is Tracy Kidder's 1981 True Tech Tale of Engineering Heroism, The Soul of a New Machine.
It was a seminal book. Still is.
Yes.
Right?
It's been in print all this time for a reason, I tell you. So here's the story. So the time is 1978. The place is the Data General Computer Company. And really, you kind of feel like you're embedded in this group of about 30 young computer engineers. And they've all been conscripted for this mission by their manager, a very enigmatic figure named Tom West. And he's tasked them with doing something that might actually be impossible, which is to design and debug a 32-bit mini computer in a year.
Wow.
And they need to do it in a year because, frankly, Data General has fallen behind the times. Their competitors are sweeping the floor with them because they do not have this 32-bit machine on the market. And so it's up to this group of engineers to pull together and really try to overcome this maybe impossible challenge.
And it's a story all about management and geekery and all kind of combination.
Yeah, the corporate conniving in this book. You know, some things don't change, right?
But it also sets the stage for what we would later know about the people who work in dark places in the basement overnight, coding and things like that.
Yeah, these hackers might have, you know, been wearing suits and they were working at a very respectable corporation, but they were definitely hackers at heart. And I do want to tell people, if you're listening right now, we are very proud to be giving away 20 free copies of The Soul of a New Machine. This is our third time partnering with Powell's Books. We thank them very much for providing us with these 20 free copies. We would like you to get one of these. And the way that you do that is you go to sciencefriday.com, you click on the little graphic, says Soul of a New Machine, fill out that little form. We're going to close it at 8 p.m., so don't wait. If you're one of the lucky few, we're going to pick them at random. You're going to get a copy of this book, courtesy of Powell's Books, sent to you for free.
Now, you know, I couldn't wait. I'm about halfway through the book.
I know.
And you really couldn't ask for a better storyteller than Tracy Kidder.
No. He is, I think, without peer. And, you know, something I thought that was pretty interesting is he wasn't sold on this topic right away. He was kind of skeptical. You know, could you bring out a world-class drama from, you know, some geeks building a computer? And what finally convinced him was listening to these Data General engineers talk about their jobs. So here is Tracy Kidder.
When I was first introduced to these members of West's team, particularly this guy, Carl Alsing, I heard all this martial language and you know, there seemed to be all this passion behind it and people who shot from the hip and blood on the floor. And, you know, and he was talking about the creation of immobile plastic metal boxes. So I thought it really gripped me, I must say.
Mm-hmm. And you get the impression from reading, but they're not doing it for the money, right?
No, they definitely are not. And just to follow up on that bit about the Marshall language, so Kidder had an engineer actually take him aside and tell him, I kid you not, about the great shootout at Hojo's. And what this was two competing computer design groups having an argument at Howard Johnson's. That's what the great shootout at Hojo's was. So Tracy Kidder had to figure out, you know, what's going on here? Why are these guys talking about their job like it's some kind of spaghetti western? Mm-hmm. No, they were absolutely not doing it for the money.
Yes, and that's all over the book. And he had a chance to talk to a few of them.
Yeah, I've spoken to some of these engineers who are featured in the book, and what's amazing is they have that passion today. It is 34 years later, and I was speaking to Betty Shanahan, who was one of the engineers who was writing the microcode for this new machine. And here's how she described her career as an engineer 34 years later. Here's Betty.
It is so exciting to be a part of a group that makes something that makes a difference. I'm doing something that no one else has done before to give a benefit that hasn't been out there before. Imagine getting paid for that.
Engineers are special people, I can tell you that. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Annie Minoff about our book club selection, which is Tracy Kidder's Soul of a New Machine.
Soul of a New Machine. And you know, it's been, as I mentioned, 34 years. In some ways, this book feels a little bit dated. You know, you'll come across a sentence every once in a while, like Kidder tells us, for example, that increasingly computers communicate with other computers across vast distances. So, you know, it sounds a little quaint in 2015. But really, he was very smart because this is a book. It's not, you know, it's about the technology, but it's really about the people. It's about what drives this core group of really creative people to put everything they have, their soul, into this new machine. And, you know, questions of creativity and management are ones that are as alive today as they ever were.
And, you know, a lot of young people think that Silicon Valley invented computers. You know,
nope. Well,
there was the 128 Carter. I remember it distinctly.
Let's not forget the Silicon Prairie. You know, everyone watching Halt and Catch Fire right now will tell you about the Silicon Prairie. So, no, it's very true.
And this takes us back to that time, exciting times. Well, you might think you could talk about it today with the engineers who are around today, and they'll tell you that's exactly what it feels like and still feels like.
Well, now. I wonder how many engineers, young engineers today, kind of know about their predecessors, know what a mini computer was. You know, this was a machine that was somewhere in between personal computers that hadn't been invented yet,
right,
and mainframes.
Right.
So you know, it was considered small because it was about the size of a washer-dryer combo. So
let's tell people again how to join the book club.
Yes. So how do you join? You start reading. that's how you join. You go to sciencefriday.com. You can enter to win one of these free books before 8 p.m. tonight. And we'd really like to hear from you. So, you know, stay in touch as you're reading over these next 3 weeks. Use our hashtag SciFriBookClub to tell us what you think. And we've got a number of activities coming your way in the coming weeks. If you're an educator, if you're a parent, you want to teach your kids about binary, we have an educational activity coming out. We have a Google Hangout that we're putting together with some of these engineers who are in the book so that you can ask them questions. That's in the ether. That's online.
Wow.
Anyone can join. Wow. And then here in New York City, if you happen to be local, we're working with Google here in the city to set up a live Q&A with Tracy Kidder so you can ask him about the book as well. So lots of good stuff. Go to sciencefriday.com/bookclub and follow us at SciFry.
And so when will we have you back to talk about it?
Well, we've got 3 weeks to get reading, and then we'll be back same time, same place on the show Friday, August 28th. So we really encourage you, you know, if you're reading the book, take some notes and call us. You know, tell us what you think. Join that discussion on August 28th. Mark your calendars.
Annie Minoff, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Well, it's a great book, Tracy Kidder's Soul of a New Machine. Annie Minoff is a Science Friday SciArts producer. Oh, one last thing. In case you missed it, there is a cool Twitter campaign that is going viral, and it's designed to break down the stereotype of what engineers, speaking of them, look like. If you think that all engineers look alike, or they look like Wolowitz on the Big Bang Theory or Bill Nye, search Twitter for the hashtag, I Look Like an Engineer. That's a hashtag, I Look Like an Engineer. to update your mental image of what engineers and geeks really look like today. You know, it all started with engineer Isis Arkeli, who was shocked by the tsunami of attention she got when her photo appeared in an ad for her company. And you can read her story at sci-fi.me/looks-like-an-engineer. sci-fi.me/looks-like-an-engineer. That's about all the time we have for today. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. SciArts producer, Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Our production assistant is Betty Fogel. Our intern is Ella Fetter, who, we're going to have to bid a fond farewell to her today. She so enlivened our presence with her wit, knowledge, and enthusiasm. We're going to miss her. We wish her all the best. All the best to you, Ella. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And you might be familiar with blue morpho butterflies, whose wings are bright iridescent blue. It's the star of our picture of the week. Yeah, it's our picture of the week, featuring a type of blue morpho you may never have seen before. Check it out at sciencefriday.com/butterflies. Lots of good activities for you to do this weekend with Science Friday.